So with that, I think it's time to begin. So just a few minutes of introduction. The choice of our learning has been, after putting to a vote, has been Rambam's Mor Nevuchim, otherwise known as the Guide for the Perplexed. And I'm going to use those two terms interchangeably. We're not going to be using the original name, which was actually known as the Dalalat al-Harim. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but it was written originally in Arabic. Okay, it was written in what's called Judeo-Arabic, actually, which means that the Rambam implored, actually, Hebrew characters to write the Arabic language. Okay, I don't read Arabic, let alone Judeo-Arabic, so we're not going to be using the original, but there are a good number of translations out there. This is the one that I like, the Michael Friedlander edition, printed by Dover. It's concise, it's one volume, it's good. There's also a good version out by Shlomo Pines, which is a good version, but this is the one I like to use, and that's what we're going to be using, hopefully. Just a word of background. If you open up your source packets, I hope everyone has them. Sorry?
I should do the source packets?
Yeah. Okay. The source packets have things that the Mor Nevuchim itself doesn't. This week, as was mentioned before, this week I've included the selections that we're going to be reading from the Mor Nevuchim. In the future, I'd like to limit that as much as possible just for the sake of saving space. If you see on the inside cover here, I have a timeline of the Rambam's life. Before we really get started, before we really dive into it, it's important we have some perspective as to who the Rambam was, what his life work consisted of. So as you see in the timeline here, the Rambam was born in the year 1135, we're talking about CE, right? Born in Cordoba, Spain. His father, Rav Maimon, he was a great scholar, a dayan in the community, and he was a student himself of who's known as the Rimi Gash, Rav Yosef Ibn Migash. At 1148, his family was forced to leave Cordoba when Rambam was age 13, fleeing, the fanatical Muslim sect, the Almohad persecution. In 1158, at a very young age, he writes his first major work in the Milat Higayon, which was really a philosophical work on logic, and Ma'amar Ha'ibur on the Jewish calendar. And he begins to write his commentary on the Mishnah at the tender age of only 23 years old. Quite an intimidating fact if you've ever seen the Rambam's commentary on the Mishnah. And in 1160, finally, his family settles in Fez in Morocco, and there the Rambam continued his study. He also there began to study medicine with great North African physicians, something that we'll get back to later, something that was mentioned by Mrs. Davidoff, that indeed the Rambam did make his living through the practice of medicine. In 1165, he leaves Fez for Eretz Yisrael. Right, due to persecutions, due to more Muslim persecutions in Morocco, he left to go to Eretz Yisrael, landed in Akko, but Eretz Yisrael wasn't too safe either. We're talking about in between the time of the First and Second Crusades. Eretz Yisrael was a very dangerous place indeed, and the Rambam's family was forced to leave. And why they went exactly to Cairo is a little unclear, but nevertheless, they ended up in Cairo in Egypt. In 1168, he completed his commentary to the Mishnah, and this is the Rambam's first major literary work. It's the first extensive commentary focused solely on the Mishnah. And in Egypt, the Rambam was constantly, continuously involved in communal affairs as well. In 1172, he was approached by the community of Yemen. The community of Yemen was dealing with a series of very traumatic events. Number one being the rise of a false messiah in that time. Number two being tremendous persecutions that were forcing people to either convert or to Islam or to face death. And they turned to Maimonides, they turned to the Rambam for advice and what to do. And the Rambam wrote them a letter really consoling them and encouraging them, uplifting the community. And the community was extremely, extremely grateful. They even inserted a specific prayer for the Rambam's behalf into their Kaddish. To this day, many facets of the Yemenite community strictly follow the Rambam's halachic decisions. Okay, so to this day, this is really an impact that's strongly felt in the Yemenite community. In 1174, in Egypt, he began practicing medicine upon the death of his brother. He was supported before that by his brother, who was very wealthy, who was trading in gems. His brother David was supporting him, and when he died, the Rambam was completely distraught. The Rambam, he mentions in some letters that he spent about a year completely inactive, just mourning his brother's loss. Okay, and he was completely devastated by the loss of his brother, as well as by means that he was supported. So he began practicing medicine in 1174, and in 1180, after 10 years of hard work, he completes his major work, the Mishneh Torah, which is the systematic codification of the entire corpus of Jewish law. And it really can't be emphasized enough how revolutionary this was for Judaism in general, and for Halakha in particular. This here is the first volume of the Mishneh Torah I have here, Sefer Hamada. It's composed of 14 books. That's why it's known as the Yad HaChazakah. The Rambam called it the Yad HaChazakah, Yad being the gematria of 14. There are 14 separate books. This is the first one, Sefer Hamada. And it really is the first systematic attempt to codify all the halakhic decisions of the Talmud. Right, previously, Rav Yitzchak Alfasi, the Rif, wrote a Sefer HaHalachot, wrote a halakhic compendium of the decisions of the Talmud, but that really followed the order of the Talmud itself. Meaning, according to each tractate, he simply followed the order of the tractate and then edited the halakhic material. He collected all the halakhic conclusions of the Talmud according to the order of the Talmud, but it wasn't really systematized. It wasn't really codified in a systemic matter. And that was the first thing the Rambam undertook. And that was his major, major accomplishment. Right, when the Mishneh Torah first came out, it was extremely controversial, right, for various reasons. One of the main reasons is what the Rambam himself states in his introduction, that he wrote this book with the intention of essentially supplanting the Talmud. And he says, all you need, if you read his introduction, he says, when I complete this book, the goal is that all you'll need is a Tanakh and the Mishneh Torah. Right, that's what he says. So that statement got him into a lot of trouble. Right, people were very, very upset. It's kind of ironic that he kind of, you know, intended this to be the, you know, the final stop for Jewish law, and has been to date 300 or probably many more commentaries on the Mishneh Torah itself. So it was by no means the end all. Another thing that got the Rambam into major trouble in the Mishneh Torah was that he didn't source his decisions. Okay, he simply quoted what the halacha is, but he didn't say whose opinion he was quoting, he didn't say where he was getting it from, and indeed a lot of the commentaries focus on that task, on really sourcing the Rambam.
I think the reason that he wanted to supplant the Talmud was that he was sort of an opponent of what today we would call the Kollel lifestyle, and I think basically he wanted to make the yeshiva system obsolete. I think that was kind of what he had in mind.
Just want to address that for 1 second. So, in terms of how the educational system was set up in the Rambam's time, I don't think it's fair to assume that it was similar to what we have today. The Rambam, if you look in the Rambam in Hilchot Talmud Torah, actually, which is in Sefer Hamada, found in Sefer Hamada, he actually lays out what he sees as educational prescription for how communities should set up their schools. So the answer to that question, I think, really should be found in the Rambam's Hilchos Talmud Torah, which you don't really have time to get into, but certainly the Rambam was quite opposed to earning a living through Torah study, which is why he began to practice medicine. Right? He was already the rabbi in the community in Cairo, in Egypt, and he was offered by the government there to accept a salary for that position, and he declined. And he writes very vehemently why he declined, saying that I don't remember the exact quote, but it was much better for, you know, to make your living doing the most menial job than to make your living through learning Torah. So certainly the Rambam was opposed to earning a salary through learning Torah, right. And that's why he began to practice medicine. In terms of that being a motivation for why he wrote the Mishneh Torah, I'm not sure. So in 1185, he was appointed the royal physician to the emperor in Egypt, and his fame really began to spread. It's a great article in the Rambam in the Encyclopedia Judaica, and there it actually says that apparently Richard the Lionhearted wanted Rambam to be his personal physician as well. Okay, his fame was widespread, and in fact, the Rambam has many medical works, which have been translated, many into English, by Dr. Fred Rosner. His fame in the medical world reached far and wide as well. And finally, in 1190, after about another 10 years of hard work, he composed our Sefer, the Mor Nevuchim, the Guide for the Perplexed. And it was really a landmark philosophical work, and as we'll see, it was formally addressed to a single student. It was written in Arabic to allow access to a wider readership, and also it was the philosophical language of the day. Right? The preeminent philosophers of the day were writing in medieval Arabic, and that's what the Rambam chose as well. And in fact, the only book the Rambam ever wrote in Hebrew was the Mishneh Torah. Okay, so the Mishneh Torah, we have the original. All the other works, this commentary to the Mishnah, right? The Mor Nevuchim, all the Igaret Hamam, etc., all the Rambam's other works are all written in Arabic. Okay, the Rambam actually regretted not translating the Mor Nevuchim himself into Hebrew later, but it was translated in his lifetime, and that's important. The Rav Shmuel Ibn Tibon was a wonderful, wonderful scholar, and he translated the Mornavuchim in the Rambam's lifetime and consulted the Rambam himself on difficult passages. And the Rambam, the Rambam was approached by certain communities to translate the Mornavuchim himself, and he declined, saying that, well, there's a very capable person already doing it, I'm too old, I don't have the time, etc., etc. So the Rambam himself gave the approbation to Shmuel Ibn Tibbon's translation, which we're not going to use because we're going to use the English translation, but it is available in many different iterations, and if you're interested, it's out there. So that's a basic overview of the Rambam's life. Okay, I'm sure some of you have heard that the famous epithet engraved on the Rambam's tombstone, what kind of became known to encapsulate his greatness, was the statement from Mimosha ad Moshe lo kam b'Yisrael kemoshe, right? From Moses until Moshe until Rambam, there was never one in the Jewish people like Moshe, right? So really, the preeminent thinker of post-Talmudic times, right, and probably the most influential as well. The Rambam greatly influenced, through his Mishneh Torah, greatly influenced the entire development of Halakha. The wording of the Shulchan Aruch very often is very heavily based on the Rambam. Okay, you can't learn in any yeshiva in the world, pay serious attention to any Talmudic subject without consulting the Rambam. So yeah.
The translation we're using is English. Is that from the Arabic or from the Hebrew?
Good question. It's from the Arabic.
It's from the original source.
Yeah, it's from the original Arabic. Correct. There have been other translations from the original Arabic. Recently, also Rav Yosef Kafach, who is a tremendous scholar, specifically in Rambam, so he translated from the original Arabic as well. It's printed by Mossad HaRav Kook into Hebrew. He translated into Hebrew. The Pines translation into English, I believe, is also from the original Arabic. So I personally like this translation, but it is from the original Arabic text. Okay, so with that being said, our goal essentially, just to give you a heads up what's going to be over the next few weeks, our goal is to eventually deal with the Rambam's section of the Mornavuchim where he deals with the Ta'ameha Mitzvot, where he deals with the reasons for the Mitzvot. The Rambam divided his Mornavuchim into three sections. Okay, the first and second sections we're going to skip essentially. The section 3 is where he really focuses on our topic. But in order to approach the Mornavuchim, I do believe it's essential to really delve into the Rambam's introduction. His introduction is fascinating. His introduction is really a limud in itself. It's really like its own series of shiurim, and we're going to do two. Okay, the first two shiurim we're going to do is essentially on the Rambam's introduction. Today we're going to focus on certain challenges the Rambam had in composing this book. And in the next shiur we're going to focus on how the Rambam's interpretation of a specific Talmudic passage, which we'll get to. But just to start us off, I don't know if everyone has had a chance to read it yet, but the Rambam started his book with a letter, a personal letter to a pupil. Okay, as you see in source number 1, on page 1 in the sources, I have it printed here. It's the letter of the author to his pupil, Rav Yosef ibn Aknin. The Encyclopedia Judaica mentions that his name was actually Yosef ibn Shamun. I don't know if that means anything to you. Does it make a difference? To me, it doesn't really make much of a difference, right? I don't know. So, did everybody get a chance to read it?
Yeah.
Okay.
How would he have gotten the name wrong of such a close and prized pupil? There must be something there.
I don't think they're suggesting the Rambam got it wrong. I'm suggesting that scholars have somehow got the communication wrong. I don't think they're saying the Rambam got his name wrong. Yeah. Right? I'm not sure. I didn't really look into that so much, but whether his name was Ibn Aknin or Ibn Shamun, I'm not sure familiar with either of them. But a couple of things I wanted to point out in this letter. The Rambam in this letter really frames the purpose of the Mornavuchim, and it's significant, as we'll shortly see, that he's addressing it formally. The Mornavuchim is addressed to a single student. That's very significant. So if you look in towards the beginning, he says, you know, I refer to the time when I received your writings in prose and verse from Alexandria. I was then not yet able to test your powers of apprehension, and I thought your desire might possibly exceed your capacity. Okay? A common phenomenon in learning, sometimes people are so eager to learn, and you want to know the answer to a question, that you tend to kind of overstep your bounds. And that's what the Rambam was worried about here with this student as well, which is why he hesitated in replying to certain queries that this student had. What the nature of those queries were, we're not sure, but we'll see in a minute. Okay? But when you had gone with me through a course of astronomy, and having completed the other elementary studies which are indispensable for the understanding of that science, I was still more gratified by the acuteness and quickness of your apprehension. So this Talmud, this student, really seemed to impress the Rambam. Okay? He seemed to really have excelled in his studies. Then he took him through a course of logic, etc., etc. And if you look towards the bottom, he says he wanted him to teach him additional explanation, urging me to expound some metaphysical problems, to teach you the system of the Netu Kalemim, to tell you whether their arguments were based on logical proof, and if not, what their method was. Just parenthetically, the Netu Kalemim refers to a school of philosophical Islam known as the Kalam. It was a school of philosophy in Islam that really sought to understand God through logic, through reasoning, through dialectic. So that's what the Rambam has a whole section in Mor Nebuchim dealing with that school of thought. We're not going to deal with it. Okay? I'm not a scholar of the Kalam, and I don't. It's not really relevant for our topic. But the next line is critical. He says, the Rambam said to this Talmud, I urge you to desist from this pursuit, and enjoined you to continue your studies systematically. For my object was that the truth should present itself in connected order, and you should not hate upon it by mere chance. As we'll see, throughout the Rambam's introduction, this is a common theme. And we know from the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, he held this in highest regard. Right? The Rambam was not only a scholar, but he was the pedagogue par excellence. And he emphasized the importance of systematic progression in studies.
But okay? It's more into scientific, say, medical mind, as opposed to others.
Possibly, yeah. Possibly. Okay, I would
but
see how that goes hand in hand.
You have to go step, you know, you don't give a first grader...
Right.
Right. You gotta crawl before you walk.
But, you know, we may take that for granted, but it was a big chiddush. Right, we mentioned that in terms of composing his halachic code, he was the first one to really undertake a systematic study of halacha. Right, to organize things by topic, by category, to divide them from vast area of the Talmud into different categories, into different svarim, into different types of halachot. He was the first person to do it. Okay, so as much as we take it for granted, in the Rambam's time it was quite radical. And he says this applies to the study of philosophy as well. And the third line from the bottom, he says, your absence has prompted me to compose this treatise for you and for those who are like you, however few they may be. Okay? Well, see, this is also a theme common in the Rambam. The Rambam had little patience for people of limited intellectual capacity. Okay? Right. The Rambam had many patients in terms of medical patients, as a famous letter makes it clear. But... As we'll see, the Rambam is directing this work to somewhat of an intellectual elite. All right, so when I read it, I think, well, where does that leave me? Right, what's the point in studying this work? And that's a question we have to seriously consider, given the nature of some of the subjects that the Rambam takes on in this book. Okay, and that's the question that we're going to deal with today, essentially. Is this book for us? Okay, I had an experience just yesterday. I was sitting in shul in Kins, and I was reading some of the Mor Nebuchim, and someone came up to me and he says, oh, what are you reading? So I said, it's the Mor Nebuchim. And he said, oh, I saw a responsa of Rabbi Moses Sofer, who said that you shouldn't learn this until you're 40. So I said, I guess I'm wise beyond my years. So I said, well, you know, I don't know what his source is. It doesn't seem to me to be the accepted practice. I was part of a shir that was learning Mor Nebuchim when I was in my first year in yeshiva in Israel. And the Rambam, as we'll see, the Rambam himself, I believe, thought otherwise. Okay, so the Rambam himself thought that there is something to be gained from this work, even if you're not part of the intellectual elite. But primarily, it is important to realize perspective. It is geared towards a star student such as Rav Yosef Ibn Aknin or even Shamut. Okay? And that's part of the reason, I believe, why the Rambam frames it and formally addresses the book towards a single student. Okay? So let's continue. Is that clear? Questions so far? If there are questions along the way, feel free to stop me. Okay. Source number two. I have these psukim in here kind of as to frame our study and to encourage us on our quest. In Parshin Etzavim Vayelech, Dvarim Perek Lamed, the Torah itself, right, nonetheless, in the Torah itself assures us, Ki ha-mitzvah hazot asher anochi mitzavcha hayom, lo nifleiti mimcha velo rechokahi, lo v'ashamayim hi le'emor mi ya'ale lanu ha-shamayimah, v'yikache alanu, v'yashmenu otah v'na'asena. Right, the Torah, the mitzvos, God did not give us Torah and mitzvos that are only for the intellectual elite. Right? They are not beyond our reach. Mitzvos are comprehensible. Right, they can be understood, they can be performed, They're close to us, as it says, "Velo me ever layamhi." They're not beyond the sea. Lemor mi avar lanu ela ever hayamvi kachelanu vayashmi enu otavina asena. Ki karov elacha devar meod beficha uvil vavchala asato, because it is very close to you, in order to in your heart, in order to perform the commandments. So with that in mind, let's start the actual Mora. If we look, if you can open up your books to page, I guess it's one. The same page as the letter. Excuse me, the same page as the letter. So if you look, there was something I skipped in the letter. The Rambam gives a title, pasuk, to frame the entire Mora Nevuchim. What's that pasuk? You may not recognize that it's actually a pasuk. In the name of God, Lord of the universe. Or in Hebrew, if you look on the sources, I have it there. In Hebrew, B'shem Hashem Kel Olam. The Rambam says. In the name of God. Very nice, right? He's starting his book saying in the name of God. Or it's quite a source that you're quoting. Okay, but what's the Rambam really referring to? The Rambam is quoting from somewhere. And actually, if you look in the Mishnah Torah, the way he starts his Mishnah Torah, open it right here. You can see the title page in big letters right there. V'shem Hashem Kel Olam. Okay? Same pasuk. He starts his Mishnah Torah the exact same way. So what's the Rambam getting at? Why does he choose this phrase? And the significance to that, we'll see. If you look in source number 3, the Rambam's actually quoting. Okay? He's quoting from a pasuk in Sefer Bereishis, Perchav Aleph, Pasuk Lamed Gimel, Vayita Eshel Beve'er Shava, Vayikra Sham B'Shem Hashem Kel Olam. Context? Anyone? What's the pasuk referring to?
Avraham.
Okay, Avraham. After he makes the brit with Avimelech and Fichol Tzar Tzva'o, after he makes the brit with Avimelech, he gives Avimelech 7 sheep as a symbolic of this brit, allowing Avraham to dig a well that became known as Be'er Sheva. Okay, the 7 sheep, Be'er Sheva. And it says, upon celebration of that brit, essentially, Vayita Eshel Be'er Sheva, Avraham planted a flowering tree in Be'er Sheva, and there he called in the name of Hashem, Lord of the universe. So the Rambam is quoting from this pasuk, and when a Rishonim, especially the Rambam, when they're quoting from a particular pasuk, it's not just, well, it's a nice phrase that I want to use. Right, what's the context the Rambam's referring to? He has the entire Tanakh at his disposal, and he chooses this one phrase to frame both the Mishneh Torah and the Mora Nevuchim. Okay? So if you... Yes?
Did he use the same phrase to frame other things that he wrote?
Okay, good question.
This framing phrase.
So in Rav Kafach points out that this phrase was actually used also in the commentary to the Mishnah as well. I looked in 2 editions of the commentary in the Mishnah and I didn't see it. So I'm not sure what that means. It probably means I was looking in the wrong place. Rav Kafach was, his life was dedicated to the Rambam. I'm sure he wasn't making it up. But he did, according to Rav Kafach, he did use it to also be the title of his of the Parish of Mishnayos. I didn't tell you that until now because I didn't myself see it inside. So I try not to present to you sources that I haven't seen firsthand. So the Rambam says in source 3, the significance of this pasuk is made very clear by the Talmud. And I think if we understand this Gemara, in this Gemara lies the key to how the Rambam wants us to look at his Sefer. The Talmud says as follows, the Gemara in Masechet Sota, at the end of box number 3. Vayita Eshel Be'er Sheva. The pasuk says, Avraham planted an Eshel, a flowering tree, in Be'er Sheva. Amar Esh Lakish. Milamed She'asa Pardes V'natabo Kol Mine Megadim. This teaches us that he planted an orchard, a field, a garden, and planted all sorts of delights, all sorts of fruits in that place. Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Nechemia, Chadamar Pardes V'chadamar Fundak. Now, amongst the Amoraim, there was a machloket. One said, yes, he planted Pardes like Reish Lakish. And one said, no, he didn't plant any sort of a field or an orchard. Rather, it was a fundak. A fundak is an inn or a tavern. Right? He opened up a mom and pop's bread and breakfast or something like that. So he says, the Gemara says, Bishlam alaman damar pardes, hainu dichti vayita. Wait a second. The one who says that he planted an orchard, that makes sense. Why? Because it says he planted. So how do you plant an inn? You know, it's kind of the language is not matim. It doesn't match up. El Lamanda Amar Fundak, my Vaita. What does it mean? He planted, if you say that he planted a tavern or an inn. Kidichtiv Vayita Ole Afadno. Because it says in the Pasuk in Daniel, that phrase, that word, Vayita, is used in a similar context there. So you see that it can be used in multiple senses. Fine. Vayikra Sham B'Shem Hashem Kel Olam. And this Pasuk, this phrase, the Rambam quotes, what's the meaning? Amar Yish Lakish, Al Tikri Vayikra Ela Vayakri. Don't read it as he called in the name of God. Rather, he caused the name of God to be called, meaning he taught others to call in the name of God. This teaches us that Avraham taught the name of God to be called in all the people who passed through, whether it was through his orchard or through his inn. Ketzad, and how is this so? After they ate and drank from his vineyard or in his inn, in his bed and breakfast, they got up to bless him, right? To bless the owner of the inn. Amar lahem, don't bless me. V'chin mishaliach altem. You think you ate from my produce? Mishel Elohe olam achaltem. Hodo v'shivcho u'barchu l'misha amar v'ayolam. He says, no, you're not eating from me, you're eating from God, the one who created the world. And through that, the people would come to bless God.
Okay, as a side note, as a support for the second opinion, that it was an inn and not an orchard, in modern Hebrew, Ethel is Rashi Tevot. Mm-hmm. And when a person travels on business and submits his expenses for reimbursement, Eshel is Ochel
Shtia
Velina.
Right.
Eating, drinking, and
I think there's
part of, you know, that was also, I think, probably commonly used in those days.
I believe there's a medrash to that effect.
Things that are in modern Hebrew now don't come from nowhere.
Right, exactly. Right, absolutely. So,
it's nice
that they use that
right.
It's officially a double brackets.
I'm sorry?
Kundak is there in the Gemara?
So I believe, why is it in brackets?
Yeah.
I think because the Gemara, just a word on translations actually, when I do have translations in the sources, the Psukim are usually from the Jewish Publication Society translation,
right.
And the Gemaras and Mishnayot are usually from the Cincino translation. Okay, here they used kind of a strange word, which I didn't like, so I put in my own word and that's why it's in brackets. That's my, because I edited it. Okay, thanks for pointing that out. Yeah, no, that's very observant. So, the message that the Rambam is conveying to us, I think the Rambam says, like Reish Lakish conveys, the Rambam is telling us, whatever you glean from this work, right? You think it's my own chidushim, you think it's from me, right? Mishaliach haltem, right? Misha amar v'haya ha'olam achaltem. The Rambam is saying, I'm speaking on behalf of a Kaddish Baruch Hu, essentially, that through this work, right, I'm planting this tree, so to speak, I'm planting either an inn or a tree, a place for people to come and to reap the fruits of my labor, but it's not my labor. Right? B'shem Hashem Kel Olam, I'm teaching Hashem's name, I'm causing Hashem's name to be called in the world, and recognize that whatever chachma, whatever wisdom you gain through the study of this work, comes from a Kaddish Baruch Hu. And that's the Rambam's emphasis in opening the guide and in opening the Mishneh Torah as well. According to Rav Kapach, opening the Perashah Mishnayos. Okay? So, right, there's a lot of meaning already impacted into the Rambam's even his title, Pasuk. Okay. The Rambam lays out, as he mentioned, as he hinted to in his letter, the subject of the Mor Nevuchim, a lot of it is very esoteric. Right? A lot of it deals with subjects that are really metaphysical, that are very difficult to understand. And if you look in source number 4, the Rambam spells out for us specifically who is the ideal reader of this work, something we hinted to before. In source number 4, he says, the object of this treatise is to enlighten a religious man who has been trained to believe in the truth of our holy law, conscientiously fulfills his moral and religious duties, and at the same time, been successful in his philosophical studies. Human reason has attracted him to abide within its sphere, meaning within the sphere of human reason, and he finds it difficult to accept as correct the teaching based on the literal interpretation of the law, and especially that which he himself or others derived from those homonymous, metaphorical, or hybrid expressions. Hence, he's lost in perplexity and anxiety. If he be guided solely by his reason and renounce his previous views, which are based on those expressions, he would consider that he had rejected the fundamental principles of the law. And even if he retains the opinions which were derived from those expressions, and if instead of following his reason, he abandoned its guidance altogether, it would still appear, this is critical, that his religious convictions had suffered loss and injury. For he would then be left with those errors which give rise to fear and anxiety, constant grief, and great perplexity. In that last line, Right? The Rambam essentially says that this work is really geared for someone who finds a conflict, right, between his religious personality and his intellectual personality. And he says sacrificing either one of the two would leave that person tremendously dissatisfied. If a person would sacrifice his religious lifestyles, then he would feel terrible that he abandoned the faith of his forefathers. But if he sacrificed his intellect, he would feel, what does the Rambam say? That the religious side would suffer loss and injury. Right? That poor intellectual advancement, or, you know, when not enough due is given to a person's intellect, and when a person has that need, that's very damaging to the person's religious persona as well. And that's what the Rambam emphasizes here, and that's part of the Rambam's goal in this work. He's saying he's addressing it to people who are conflicted. And certainly something that resonates in our day as well. But people find, many people, myself sometimes included, find that there's a tremendous dissonance sometimes between, apparent dissonance between religion, and whether it's philosophy, whether it's science, whether it's rationalism, whatever it may be. And the Rambam is saying a prerequisite for really delving into this work is being sensitive to that conflict. And it was pointed out by, there are a few commentaries on Mornabuch, and one of them, one of the famous commentaries is known as the Ephodi, printed with many of the Hebrew editions of the Mornabuch. The Ephodi was written by someone by the name of Rav Profiat Duran. Okay? They say the name Ephod, Aleph Pei Dalet, is an abbreviation for Amar Profiat Duran. Okay? That was his name. He was a philosopher. He was a later contemporary of the, or maybe the generation after the Rambam. And he points out that the Rambam actually lists here 7 different requirements for the ideal reader of this work. And just, to, he says, and he says each one is distinct. They're mutually exclusive. He says a religious man, number one. And number two, separately, been trained to believe in the truth of our holy law. Right? Says the Ephodi, when the Rambam says being a religious person, it doesn't mean necessarily being a frum person, what we would in our terminology. That's a separate requirement. That's requirement number two, being a frum person, so to speak. Someone who's trained in the truth of our holy law, and three, consciously fulfills his moral and religious duties, someone who practices Torah and mitzvot, someone who's been trained in Torah and mitzvot, that's number two and number three. But requirement number one, says the Ephodi, is to be a religious person. What's the difference? Well, it seems that that's number two. Trained to believe in the truth of our holy law.
Ethical.
Okay, interesting. Yeah.
Religious and observant.
Right. What's the difference between religious? So, what is the difference between religious and observant?
There are many people who are religious across the face, you know, whatever. Whereas observance, I think, it's more observance is practice. Religious is more like dogma. Somebody's beliefs.
Okay, could be dogma. Yeah, you said.
Yeah, I mean, we see this all the time. Right? In Israel, you see this, people who are very religious-minded, but they don't practice, they don't keep all the laws.
And what do you mean by religious?
I ask them if they're religious, they believe in Hashem, they're spiritual people in many ways. They're right. Spiritual, but they aren't necessarily practicing all the laws.
Right. Know the laws, right. But they're not necessarily the same thing. That's what I want to point out here. And I think a very good explanation of this can be found in Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik's book, Halachic Man. The first half of that book, Halachic Man, he describes, anyone know, he describes two personalities. Right. What he calls, right, in the English, what he calls homo religiosus, right? For the, some nice Latin terms for you there. And the Halachic Man, right, as two distinct personalities. If you really want to understand, yeah.
The cognitive man.
Right, the cognitive man, who, and then the halakhic man being the bridge between the two.
Yeah.
Right, okay? Right. The cognitive man and the... Right, thank you for the correction. The cognitive man and the religious man, right? The religious personality, who our Salvation describes as someone who sees in life, he sees transcendence, looks for the message beyond. Right, so that's the religious person. It's I highly recommend reading that book. So that's what the Rambam lays out for the ideal reader of this book.
Yeah, we're waiting for your shoe.
I just finished learning that before the credits.
Right.
Really?
Right.
Perfect. Okay. Perfect. So it's quite a book, as I'm sure you agree. So possibly that's what the Rambam is referring to here. A person must have that religious orientation, right? The desire to see transcendence in life, right? Not only to see things superficially. And then secondly, and thirdly, to be trained in our religious law, meaning to be fulfilling Torah and mitzvot. Now, the Rambam is faced with a certain problem, because the Rambam, a couple of the subjects that the Rambam deals with in the Mor Nevuchim, like we said, are very esoteric. And specifically, he deals with the prophetic visions of Yechezkel and the chariot. Okay, he deals with expounding on many metaphysical laws of nature. Okay, very esoteric stuff. And if you look in source number 5, this poses a tremendous halakhic problem for the Rambam. Because in source number 5, the Mishnah in Chagiga states as follows, Ein dorshin v'arayot b'shlosha. We do not expound, we do not teach publicly the laws of immoral relations to groups of 3 or more. V'lo b'ma'ase b'reshit b'shnayim. We do not expound on the acts of creation, on the laws of physics in terms of how the world was created in 2 people. V'lo b'merkava b'yachid. And not on the ma'ase merkava, not on the vision of the chariot of Yechezkel, even to 1 individual student. Unless, ela im kein haya chacham u'mevin midato. Unless he is tremendously wise and has the ability to understand on his own. And the Gemara states on the bottom, v'lo b'merkava b'yachid, Tana Rabbi Chia, aval moser lo roshe prakim. What do you teach to the one, this individual, this singular student who's excelled in his studies, who's a chacham? Only the roshe prakim, only chapter headings. Right? You give him little hints, you drop little hints, and he has to figure out the rest on his own. So when expounding on the Ma'aseh Merkava and on the Ma'aseh Bereshit, there's halakhic limitations that Chazal laid out as to how this can be taught. And in source number 6, the Rambam himself, in the Mishneh Torah, in Hilchot Yesod HaTorah, he quotes this Mishneh LaHalacha. In the second line over there, in Halacha Yud Aleph. Sorry, I don't have the English. Dvarim elu she'amarnu binyan zeh b'shnei prakim elu k'mo tipa min hayam hem mima she'tzarich leva'er binyan zeh u'bir kol ha'ikarim she'b'shnei prakim elu hu ha'nikre ma'aseh merkava. The first 2 chapters of the Hilchot Yesod HaTorah deal with the nature of God, the nature of angels, right? The nature of the form of metaphysical beings, right? The metaphysical structure of the universe. So that's what's called Ma'aseh Merkava. And then in the next halacha, Tzivu Chachamim Rishonim, Shelo Lidrosh Bivarim Elu, Elo Le'ish Echad Bilvad. And why not? Why did the Chachamim say to only teach to 1 person? In the last line, V'dvarim elu dvarim amukim hem adam od, because these are very deep matters, v'in kol da'at v'dat ru'ya l'sovlan, because not every person's intellectual capacity is fitting l'sovlan. What does sovlan mean?
To bear
the suffering, so to speak, I would say, of these subjects. Right? Not every person can take it. Not even
handle
that.
The load.
Right, can handle the load, exactly. Not even that every person is.
Saval is a mover.
Right, not only that, not every person is smart enough, let's say, but not every person is capable of withstanding the load of these subjects. That's how I would translate it, right? Very good. And then the next parak, and sorry, in parak Dalet, the Rambam says, similarly, regarding Ma'aseh Bereshit, the Rambam there defines what he believed in his time to be the physical laws of nature, and he talks about the 4 fundamental yisodot, the 4 fundamental particles of nature, being earth, wind, fire, water, etc., and how those compose the universe. And surely, if the Rambam had understood the laws of physics and chemistry as we today, he simply would have laid those out as well. And he says, in Halacha Yud, Kol HaDvarim HaElu SheDibarnu B'Inyan Zeh Kemar Miduli Hayam UDvarim HaMukim Hem. These are also very deep matters. Aval Einam Kinyan Omek Perek Rishon V'Sheni. They're not as deep as the first and second perek, right? Which is why there are more stringent rules on Ma'aseh Merkava than there are for Ma'aseh Bereshit. But the Rambam essentially defines Ma'aseh Bereshit as the laws of physics as they apply to understanding the creation of the world. Right? He says these are very deep matters and can very easily mislead a person into false beliefs and to misunderstanding them. And that's what he says in the bottom line, Halacha Yud Aleph. Again, why can't we teach this publicly? Lefi she'ein kol adam yesh lo dat rechava la'asig perush ubi'ur kol hadvarim al borian. Right? A little differently than what he said on Ma'aseh Merkava. He says here, because not every person has the ability, his mind hasn't been widened enough to be able to comprehend the matter fully. Not that a person can't handle it necessarily, intrinsically, like it was the case with Ma'aseh Merkava, just that people aren't as intellectually advanced enough. Right? Certainly, I know today this strikes me as very relevant. There's a lot of talk today that you've seen in newspapers recently about books that have come out about essentially Ma'aseh Bereshit, right? About how exactly the world was created, understanding the physics of how the world was created, right? And the Rambam, if you if you...
All right, now we're being brought up.
We're whispering about, like, what am I doing
like,
here?
Like, on the basis of that, do we, and, you know, I mean, present company excluded, do you think we have this capacity?
How do you know if, like, you should,
good.
You know, pursue this or not?
Good, good, good.
I mean, she, like, say, Ethel...
Right. So, to an extent, right. You're not the only one thinking it, including myself.
You're not the only one wondering why you're here.
Right. Including myself. Right. And the Rambam, as we mentioned,
all of us are wondering why we're here. We're the ones who need to be here.
Right. Just a disclaimer, sorry, that before this year is over, I'll leave it on an encouraging note. But the just a disclaimer in the Rambam. Like I said, the Rambam has very, very, very high standards. Okay. The Rambam is ideally talking to an intellectual elite, but as right, but as we'll see,
honors AP.
But as we'll see soon, the Rambam does qualify it, and he says there is something to be gained even for what we would possibly consider ourselves being the masses. And the Rambam, this poses a very serious problem. The good news for us, by the way, just as you mentioned it. We're not going to be dealing with the sections of Morna Vuchum that deal with Maaseh Merkava and Maaseh Bereishit. Okay, we're not going to be dealing with those sections. I know we're focusing, our topic is Tamei Mitzvot, but I think it's very important to see, well, in terms of framing the Rambam, understanding this work, how does the Rambam deal with this problem? Because as the Rambam himself says, if an author were to explain these principles in writing, it would be equal to expounding them unto thousands of men. So how does the Rambam get away with writing a book like this, dealing with these subjects? Obviously, you're doing it in a public forum. It was translated in his lifetime. So what does he do? And yes, I think part of the answer is the fact that he formally addresses the work to a single student. And that is part of the answer, but it's not adequate. The Rambam knew that other people were going to be reading this book. It was translated. The single student didn't need a translation. Okay? So how does the Rambam deal with it? So let's look, one second, source number 7. In section 3 of this year, this is where we move to the final stretch. The Rambam's answer to this question lies in methodology. Right? The Rambam being the pedagogue par excellence, he understands that the way to deal with this problem is through how you teach it. Remember, what's the reason? And the Rambam explicitly stated in the Mishneh Torah, there were specific reasons why Chazal said you were not permitted to teach these subjects. The Rambam doesn't often kind of digress into what he thinks are the reasons behind a Mishnah. The Mishnah didn't say this is the reason why. The Mishnah said, Ein Dorshin. The Mishnah said, you can't expound upon these subjects publicly. And the Rambam, on his own, said, well, the reason for that is because people are either intrinsically unable to withstand the burden of these studies, or because people just aren't yet advanced enough in their studies. That's the Rambam's own addition. And the Rambam thinks that's critical to the prohibition. In source number 7, he says, Maaseh Bereishit signified natural science, and Maaseh Merkava, metaphysics, and we explain the force of the rabbinical dictum, Maaseh Bereishit must not be fully expounded, even the presence of a single student. Maaseh Merkava, excuse me, must not be fully expounded even in the presence of a single student, unless he be wise and able to reason for himself, etc. So the Rambam quotes this Mishnah in the next line. You must therefore not expect from me more than such heads, meaning the chapter heads, the Roshei Prakim. And even these have not been methodically and systematically arranged in this work. Right? The Rambam, who so prizes being systematic, he says, it's not systematic specifically, but I've been on the contrary, scattered and are interspersed with other topics which we have occasion to explain. My object in adopting this arrangement is that truths should at one time be apparent and at another time concealed. Thus we shall not be in opposition to the divine will from which it is wrong to deviate, which has withheld from the multitudes the truths required for the knowledge of God according to the words, the secret of the Lord is with them that fear him. So the Rambam says the first step in answering this problem is that he's going to write his work deliberately in a confusing manner. Right, also not so encouraging for us. But it's going to be deliberately confusing, meaning he's going to intersperse topics throughout the work, and it'll be up to the reader to piece them together properly. This way, he assures that the only people that have access are the ones who are capable. Right? The Rambam, and brilliantly, the Rambam has a brilliant way of structuring all his works, and he brilliantly is able to structure this work to undermine essentially the prohibition.
It doesn't do that in the Mishnah Torah.
No, not at all. In the Mishnah Torah, that's a good point. The Mishnah Torah, the reason why he doesn't do that, it's for an entirely different audience. The Rambam, in his introduction to the Mishnah Torah, says the Mishnah Torah is for everybody. Mishnah Torah is for everybody. And he does expound on some of these subjects that we're talking about in the Mishnah Torah itself, but in very basic, in a very, very basic form.
So what you're telling us is that the guide for the perplexed is deliberately perplexing.
Yes. That is what I'm telling you. The guide for the perplexed is deliberately perplexing, right, in regard to these subjects. The Maaseh Bereishit and Maaseh Merkava. And the Mishnah Torah is for an entirely different audience, which is also the reason why he wrote it in Hebrew. Okay? Because he understood that it was going to be for the entire Jewish populace, and he wanted it to be used for, you know, for generations. Yeah.
We've been told that you aren't supposed to learn Kabbalah until you're 40. Is this consistent with that? Is that possibly, right, or is he using Kabbalah
right
here?
To my knowledge, this is not what we would define as Kabbalah. Right? This is, you know, rationalism essentially. Okay.
So the guide for the perplexed is not for those who are perplexed.
Oh, it is.
No, so with the Rambam stated, good, I hear what you're saying.
One has to have such maturity and such knowledge before he can even touch that. I mean, this is
right. Right, before he can glean the maximum from it, I would say, as we'll see soon. Okay, as we'll see soon. So let's skip to source 9. If you look, and by the way, over the next week or so, or 2 weeks until we meet again, I would highly recommend reading the entire introduction to the Guide for the Perplexed. It's fascinating. And it really touches on a lot of issues that are relevant way beyond the guide itself. Okay? In the second paragraph, the Rambam is addressing himself to whoever reads this book. He says, should he notice, meaning the reader, any opinions with which he does not agree, let him endeavor to find a suitable explanation, even if it seems far-fetched, in order that he may judge me charitably. The Rambam is pleading, this work is not going to be perfect. Right? These explanations are not going to be complete, and you'll find things that you disagree with. But such a duty we owe to everyone. We owe it especially to our scholars and theologians who endeavor to teach us what is truth according to the best of their ability. The Rambam says, listen, I only do the best I can. And if something doesn't make sense, be down the kafskos, give me the benefit of the doubt. And then he says, I feel assured that those of my readers who have not studied philosophy will still derive profit from many a chapter. But the thinker whose studies have brought him into collision with religion will, as I've already mentioned, derive much benefit from every chapter. How greatly will he rejoice, how agreeable will my words strike his ears. So the Rambam understands there are different kinds of readers to this work. Right? This might be where we fall in. Right? There is benefit to be derived from every chapter, says the Rambam. Right? And there is what to be gained. And I think that's an important point to emphasize. And he says, God knows that I hesitated very much before writing on the subjects contained in this work, since they're profound mysteries. They are topics which, since the time of our captivity, have not been treated by any of our scholars as far as we possess their writings. Right? He's lamenting on the dearth of writings in Jewish philosophy until his time. How then shall I now make a beginning and discuss them? But I rely on two precedents. Finally, what does the Rambam say? Why can he essentially go against the Mishnah? There are two precedents. First, to similar cases, our sages applied the verse, it is time to do something in honor of the Lord, for they have made void thy law. Et lasot lashem heferu toratecha. There's a special chazal sometimes invoke this pasuk in Tehillim. Et lasot lashem heferu toratecha, to say that time may warrant extra legal action. That sometimes, yes, it really may be prohibited by the Mishnah, but the Rambam feels that the need is so pressing in his time. I think certainly in our time as well, when there's that contradiction, people are so perplexed by that contradiction between faith and reason, between science and religion, however you want to frame it, whatever you want to call it, he says, in some sense, we have to go extra legal. And the second precedent, let all thy acts be for the sake of heaven. Kol ma'asecha yu l'shem shamayim. The Mishnah in Avos, I have in source 11. My sources 10 and 11 are those two sources. And Rashi says in source 10 regarding the first one, Rabotenu darshu mimenu she'ovrin al divrei Torah kedei la'asot siyag v'geder li'Yisrael. We transgress the words of the Torah, say Chazal, in order to protect the Jewish people, the faith of the Jewish people. And that's essentially what the Rambam is saying here. Okay, source 8, I believe we're pretty much out of time for it, but it's a fascinating red dot that explains on that pasuk the Rambam previously quoted, the secret of the Lord is with them that fear Him. Sod Hashem l'Reyad v'Brito l'Hodiyam. The Radak explains that pasuk as follows. I'll say it outside. He says that Sod Hashem l'Re'av, the secret of Hashem, is only with those that fear him. Meaning fear, having fear of God, Yirat Hashem, Yirat Shemayim, is a prerequisite to any study of Torah, and certainly a prerequisite to this work. And if a person has Yirat Hashem, Uvrito Lahodiyam, there's a brit. God promises and assures that there is something to be gleaned from that Torah study. If the Torah study has its antecedent in Yirat Shemayim, that Torah study is assured to be fruitful. Right, that Torah study is assured. There's a brit with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's assured that Hashem will reveal us His secrets. And hopefully, with that in mind, we can dive into our study. Next time we meet, I want to deal with how the Rambam deals with a specific fascinating story in Chazal that really relates to the dangers and the rewards of entering this field of study. And like I said, I would just end on an encouraging note that we're not going to be dealing with Maaseh Merkava and Maaseh Bereishit, because I'm not qualified. But we are going to be dealing with Tamei Mitzvot, which I do think falls under what the Rambam qualified as something that will be accessible to all, and will be really very, very relevant to our lives. So Bezrat Hashem, we'll meet again in 2 weeks. And thank you very much. Yeah.